Senator, I do want to be clear that I have never discriminated on the basis of sexual preference and would not ever discriminate on the basis of sexual preference.
Ovid is definitely for those seeking non-mainstream fare.
Do you think she is or isn't in the family?
Tamara, why are you always constantly clacking women?
We're lesbians, remember, Cheryl?
J'ai beaucoup à faire, par exemple. Prends un livre et installe-toi là.
Thank goodness for subtitles.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Chile progresses and Peru is pressured on marriage equality. Pro-LGBTQ senators challenge U.S. High Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. And a queer ovation for Ovid.tv. Your stories and more this week now that you've found This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 17th, 2020. There's finally been movement towards marriage equality in Chile. The Senate's Constitution, Legislation, Justice, and Regulations Commission approved more than half of the articles of an equal marriage bill on October 16th. It's been 3 years since the legislation was originally proposed by then-President Michelle Bachelet. It was the result of a friendly settlement agreement Bachelet had signed with the country's leading queer rights group, the Homosexual Integration and Liberation Movement, or MOVIL. Passage of the measure will bring Chile into compliance with the original Inter-American Court of Human Rights order that all members of the Organization of American States open civil marriage to same-gender couples. A statement from MOVIL noted that, among the articles approved this day are those that recognize marriage between people of the same sex, the legal representation of children by same-sex couples, the replacement of the words father or mother for that of parents, and the recognition of filiation for those who are children of same-sex couples. El Periodista quoted MOVIL attorney Monica Arias saying, "We can undoubtedly say that the Constitution Commission said yes to equal marriage." MOVIL spokesman Oscar Rementerra added, "This is good news, since positive progress was made in more than half of the project." The remaining articles of the legislation are still being debated. It's unclear when lawmakers might finally vote on the bill.
Like Chile, the government of Peru is also being pressured to comply with the same Inter-American Court marriage equality order. LGBTQ advocacy groups, lawyers, and educators across the country signed on to an open letter to the Constitutional Court this week, urging them to rule on an unresolved marriage equality case. The letter was addressed to Court President Marianela Ledesma, according to La Repubblica. It expresses the signatories' deep concern over the fact that more than 2 years after the public hearing of the case, the plenary session of the Constitutional Court has not yet issued the corresponding ruling. The letter also charges that the delay degrades the quality of human rights protections that Peru intends to give its citizens. Judges heard arguments in the case in June 2018. Peruvian activist Oscar Ugarteche sued after authorities refused to register his legal marriage to Mexican citizen Fidel Aroche. The suit cites provisions of Peru's civil code that define marriage as being between one man and one woman. Ugarteche and Aroche legally married in Mexico in October 2010. After exhausting other avenues of appeal, Ugarteche filed suit in 2012, demanding that Peruvian authorities register the marriage. As yet, there's been no response to the letter from the Constitutional Court.
A leading Orthodox rabbi in Israel said this week that Jewish law does not forbid LGBTQ people from having children and building families. Rabbi Benny Lau is a well-known progressive voice in Israel's religious Zionism, an Orthodox movement to the left of the more conservative Haredi Orthodox community. Rabbi Lau issued a statement on October 10th via Facebook with the title, "It is not good for humans to be alone. Relationships and family for the sons and daughters of the LGBT community." The rabbi wrote that, Every person's desire to bring life into the world is deep and innate in nature. No one can and must not suppress this inner desire. That support extends to the children of queer couples. Lau wrote, "Like their parents, the children of the couple did not sin and are not different from all other children. Care must be taken not to harm their dignity." Queer couples can't legally marry in Israel, so Lau suggested that they hold commitment ceremonies that their families might feel more comfortable attending. Rabbi Lau has come under fire in the past from the Orthodox community for his support of LGBTQ people. But some say he is well-connected. According to the Times of Israel, he's the nephew of Israel's former chief rabbi and the cousin of the current Ashkenazi chief rabbi. His brother is an openly gay rabbi living in New York.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has confirmed the U.S. citizenship of the now 3-year-old child of a dual U.S. and Canadian citizen and his Israeli citizen husband. Andrew and Elad Dvash Banks married in Canada in 2010. Their twin sons, Aiden and Ethan, were born via a Canadian surrogate. The boys came from different donor eggs from the same surrogate, with Aiden biologically related to the U.S. citizen Andrew. The State Department had no problem declaring Aiden a U.S. citizen. However, authorities balked at extending citizenship to Aiden's brother Ethan, because he is only biologically related to the Israeli dad, Elad. They call that being born out of wedlock. This week's appeals court decision upheld a federal district court ruling originally handed down in February 2019 that certified Ethan's U.S. citizenship. The couple and their sons now live in Los Angeles. Their case was spearheaded by the advocacy group Immigration Equality, which issued a statement for the family saying that they are overjoyed and gratified. "We hope this decision will help other LGBTQ families secure the equal rights they deserve," they added. The State Department is led by notoriously anti-queer Trump appointee Mike Pompeo and can appeal the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court. A spokesperson said only that the department was reviewing the decision.
The Texas State Board of Social Work Examiners voted this week to allow social workers to refuse to serve clients based on their sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. It revokes bans against discrimination based on sexual orientation put into force in 2010 and bans against anti-trans bias added in 2012. Infamously anti-queer Republican Governor Greg Abbott reportedly pressured the board to make the changes to conform to Texas law, which offers LGBTQ people no anti-bias protections. Texas lawmakers expanded Abbott's control over rules governing state-licensed professionals last year. Will Francis is the executive director of the Texas chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. He found the rule change to be incredibly disheartening. Austin social worker Tracy Abzug told the Texas Tribune that it is actually disturbing to me that the board has agreed to lower our standards as it relates to discrimination towards sexual orientation and gender identity. In Houston, child trauma victim specialist Stephen Parks called the rule change both a professional and a personal gut punch. The law should never allow a social worker to do unethical things. Many other social workers took to social media to express their opposition to the rule changes, though there was no sign that opposition voices, however loud, would force a reversal.
Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court refused this week to hear Idaho Governor Brad Little's repeat appeal of an appeals court ruling that allowed a trans prison inmate to undergo gender-affirming surgery. Adri Edmo was 22 years old when she was diagnosed with gender dysphoria by prison doctors in 2012. She had attempted self-castration twice. A 7-2 Supreme Court ruling this past May cleared the way for her gender-affirming surgery, which she finally had in July. Governor Little still insisted on pursuing his beef with the Ninth U.S. Circuit's ruling, but the High Court rebuffed his requested review of the case on October 13th. According to Boise State Public Radio, Edmo is only the second transgender prison inmate in U.S. history to have had gender-affirming surgery. She's also the first transgender inmate in Idaho to be transferred from a men's to a women's prison. Edmo is scheduled to be released in July 2021. Governor Little argued in his request for a high court review that state taxpayers should not have to pay for a procedure he called not medically necessary. One would think that the governor would know that the cost of the surgery was paid for by the Idaho Department of Corrections private prison health care provider, Tennessee-based Corizon Health. That covered procedure cost about $75,000. How much taxpayer money has Governor Little spent on legal fees to stop it? According to multiple reports, more than $456,000.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending October 17th, 2020. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is recording remotely during the COVID-19 emergency. It's written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more.
And you can listen to News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out radio channel on YouTube. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall. Stay healthy.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry. Stay safe.
Six different independent film distributors created the service, which seeks to present unstreamable documentaries, independent films, and notable works of international cinema.
Too much time and not enough movies? Our John Dyer V has some suggestions later in the program. U.S. Supreme Court nominee Judge Amy Coney Barrett waltzed around any substance in her responses to questions about LGBTQ rights during her confirmation hearings this week. Three Democratic Senate Judiciary Committee members tried to hold Barrett's feet to the fire about the High Court's rulings concerning marriage equality and consensual sexual activity, but all they heard was a backbeat of bias. First up, California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Do you agree with this particular point of Justice Scalia's view that the U.S. Constitution does not afford gay people the fundamental right to marry?
Senator Feinstein, as I said to Senator Graham at the outset, if I were confirmed, you would be getting Justice Barrett, not Justice Scalia. I can't, and I'm sorry to not be able to embrace or disavow Justice Scalia's position, but I really can't do that on any point of law.
Well, that's really too bad, because it's rather a fundamental point for large numbers of people, I think, in this country. You identify yourself with a justice that you, like him, would be a consistent vote to roll back hard-fought freedoms and protections for the LGBT community. And what I was hoping you would say is that this would be a point of difference where those freedoms would be respected. And you haven't said that.
Senator, I have no agenda, and I do want to be clear that I have never discriminated on the basis of sexual preference and would not ever discriminate on the basis of sexual preference. You know, like racism, I think discrimination is abhorrent. On the questions of law, however, I just, because I'm a sitting judge and because you can't answer questions without going through the judicial process, can't give answers to those very specific questions.
Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono.
This morning, Senator Feinstein asked you a question about the Supreme Court's 2015 decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, a case in which the court recognized the constitutional right to same-sex marriage. So even though you didn't give a direct answer, I think your response did speak volumes. Not once, but twice. You used the term sexual preference to describe those in the LGBTQ community. And let me make clear, sexual preference is an offensive and outdated term. It is used by anti-LGBTQ activists to suggest that sexual orientation is a choice. It is not. That sexual orientation is both a normal expression of human sexuality and immutable was a key part of the majority's opinion in Obergefell.
I certainly didn't mean, and, you know, would never mean to use a term that would cause any offense in the LGBTQ community. So if I did, I greatly apologize for that. I simply meant to be referring to Obergefell's holding with respect to same-sex marriage.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy.
Before you became a judge, you were paid by the Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, for 5 lectures. You gave them on ritualism at the Blackstone Legal Fellowship. Were you aware of ADF's decades-long efforts to recriminalize homosexuality?
I am not aware of those efforts, no.
They have filed a brief in Lawrence versus Texas in support of state laws punishing private homosexual activity. Whether you believe that being gay is right or wrong is irrelevant to me. But my concern is what you work with an organization working to criminalize people for loving a person that they are in love with.
My experience with the Blackstone program at which I spoke was a wonderful one. It gathers, you know, best and brightest Christian law students from around the country. I enjoyed teaching the students about what my specialty was, which is constitutional law.
Same-sex marriage. Do you feel that should be a crime?
Same-sex marriage?
Yes.
Obergefell clearly says that there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
And you agree with that?
Well, Senator, for the reasons that I've already said, I'm not going to, as Justice Kagan put it, give a thumbs up or thumbs down to any particular precedent. It's precedent of the Supreme Court that gives same-sex couples the right to marry.
Judge Barrett's use of the term sexual preference launched a virtual rave of word searchers at online dictionary sites. The publishers at Merriam-Webster answered their questions with the early release of a change it had already planned. Its new usage guidance notes the expression sexual preference is widely considered offensive.
Movies is magic. Life is tragic. It's time we get away to the movies and magic.
Ovid.tv is a treasure trove of movies, many off the beaten path. This way, as John Dolly V wandered around their online library and discovered 3 notably queer movies.
As a radio arts reviewer, cool stuff comes your way to hopefully be spotlighted, so to speak, on the air. One eclectic entity vying for our currently available attention is an online film library platform started in 2019 called Ovid.tv. 6 different independent film distributors created the service, which seeks to present, quote, unstreamable documentaries, independent films, and notable works of international cinema, unquote, with newer curated titles continuously added to the mix. Ovid is definitely for those seeking non-mainstream fare, so I randomly picked 3 LGBTQ+ titles to review. The large library is arranged by movie genre, or a search window can be used.
So who's the cutie?
Some customer.
She's got a nice bone structure if you're into white girls.
Do you think she is or isn't in the family?
Tamara, why are you always constantly clacking women?
We're lesbians, remember, Cheryl?
And first up was the 1996 comedic faux documentary, The Watermelon Woman, written, directed, and starring the gorgeous and very funny Cheryl Dunier, who most recently directed the astounding Lovecraft Country for HBO Max. We meet aspiring gay Philadelphia documentarian Cheryl, who wants to reveal the history of a mostly obscured black film actress of the 1930s, known only as the Watermelon Woman, due to her stereotypical mammy-type roles. Cheryl works with her best friend Tamara at the neighborhood video store. Remember those? The first third of the movie is a total crack-up, as feisty Tamara does her best to rouse a sometimes oblivious Cheryl to come out of her intellectual film research reveries and notice things like the hot lady customer making an obvious pass at her. While Tamara tells Cheryl, "You worse than white people in a bank," Cheryl prefers to shoot random footage of a rundown city block, exclaiming, It's urban realism. As Cheryl's documentary project gains some momentum, the story gets a little more serious, especially when she begins dating the flirty Caucasian lady she met at the video store. There is a wonderfully frank love scene between Cheryl and her new friend Diana, and we have now left physical comedy for topical and intellectual. The movie's fantastic soundtrack enlivens things throughout, and Dunye recreates the black-and-white film scenes showing the watermelon woman in a way that works nicely with the main story. According to Dunye, the character of Cheryl is autobiographical, while the subject of Cheryl's documentary is fictional. Dunye tells us the watermelon woman came from the real lack of any information about the lesbian and film history of African-American women. Since it wasn't happening, I invented it. Cinematography by Michelle Crenshaw honors both filmic worlds. The nicely paced editing by Annie Taylor never lags, and Paul Shapiro's original score helps tie everything together. Special mention must go to Kathy Robertson as Yvette, Cheryl's spirited karaoke singing blind date. And you will have to watch for the scene involving bald black ball busters. This film manages to combine smart comedy with an in-depth discussion of feminism, film, gender, race, and sexuality, which is quite an accomplishment these days, or any time.
C'est toi, Olivia?
Vous voulez bien de moi?
Entre, ma chérie. Mais j'ai beaucoup à faire, par exemple. Prends un livre et installe-toi là.
The next movie choice was a 1951 French film called Olivia, beautifully directed by Jacqueline Audry and one of the first French films to openly acknowledge lesbian relationships. Set in the late 19th century, it stars the entrancing Edviga Fulier, please pardon my pronunciation, as the charming and charismatic headmistress of a French finishing school for young ladies. Simone Simon, star of the original cult classic The Cat People, plays the oversensitive Mademoiselle Cara, who is a teacher and bosom friend of the headmistress, called Mademoiselle Julie. Miss Julie, get it? The third portion of this triangle is the titular Olivia. The actor's real name is Marie Claire Olivia. She is the newest student with a good head on her shoulders, which she will definitely need in order to survive. Smoldering passions are everywhere to be found at this school, and the few men in the story serve only to frown mightily upon any expressions of emotion. The sumptuous production boasts beautiful settings, drop-dead gorgeous costumes and gowns, and some really quotable lines, all the more delicious to hear in French. Thank goodness for subtitles, says Victoire, the all-knowing school cook, to spinsterish teacher Frau Riesner. In this house, it is easier to have an appetite than a head or a heart. Half the schoolgirls are crushing madly on Mademoiselle Julie, and the other half sides with the swooning teacher Mademoiselle Cara, who is at the same time completely obsessed with Miss Julie. Young Olivia literally rolls into this you-have-to-take-a-side situation, and she is no match for the worldly and alluring headmistress, who tells her things like, "I like you, dear, more than you think," and "I will come to you tonight. I will bring you candy." Mademoiselle Julie also tosses Olivia a lot of backhanded compliments. One supposes it's to keep her worked up, or at arm's length, or both. Shot at an actual French countryside estate, the stunning black-and-white photography pulls us crisply into this world that refers often to classic French romantic literature by Racine and Lamartine, all contributing to the passionate hothouse environment. From the first moment when Olivia enters the grand estate and passes through dizzying scenes of chattering, hyperactive teenage girls, to the sadder but wiser story climax when she finally leaves the school, the viewer is pulled every which way, perfectly capturing the frustrations of living between idyllic childhood and sober adulthood.
What is this?
Madrid. The last LGBTQ film screened was a pastoral and seemingly innocuous 2016 German drama called Tomcat, or Kater, in the original language. I say seemingly innocuous because of one pivotal scene that occurs almost halfway into the story of a domestic relationship between two cosmopolitan musicians who both work in a symphony orchestra. We meet Stefan and Andreas, a gay couple with an idyllic life in Vienna, where they socialize with work friends, make love a lot, and snuggle with their laid-back cat called Moses. Between making beautiful symphonic music, dancing nude to 50s jazz in their living room, and cooking fresh meals from the garden at their home nestled in the woods, one would almost think nothing dramatic is ever going to happen. Without giving too much away, something does happen quite suddenly and inexplicably, and the title of the film is a good clue as to what goes down. Suffice it to say, this viewer was shocked to the point of feeling triggered, and the moment immediately took me out of the placid storyline and into wondering how they pulled off the scene, which was incredibly realistic. The disclaimer at the end of the film credits did not completely convince me, so we'll just put it down to really good movie magic. There is one later scene of a person being severely injured, again, incredibly realistic in execution. Everything changes after the incident, and director Klaus Handel does a remarkable job of capturing the minutiae of an average life that is interrupted by tragedy. The editing is paced very deliberately, and all of the performances are seamless in conveying a community of people who, while most talented, are not larger than life in any way. It would seem all of this is meant to lull the viewer into a false sense of security, so that the surprising action hits with full and devastating impact. Lush scenes of nature, mainly of the cat wandering around the deep forest behind the house, also lend a calm to a frank and very unusual story. If you go on Ovid.tv and see the picture of the two cute guys and their kitty advertising Tomcat, just know that this is not one of those cutesy stories about the misadventures of an animal whose whimsical and humorous thoughts are sure to pull the heartstrings and make us all feel warm and fuzzy. In summation, I found the Ovid TV platform really easy to maneuver, and their content is chock-full of substantial and riveting productions that rise above some of the typical, often silly lineup on other digital library services. To visit Ovid, just go to www.ovidtv. Check it out, and here's wishing you luck that any surprises you encounter are the enjoyable kind. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Tanya Kane Perry and Christopher Gall, produced by Brian DeShazer, and from John Dyer V. Men Without Hats and Van Dyke Parks and Brian Wilson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Funds of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, a bequest from the late Christopher David Trentum, and donors Christopher Matthews and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KRZA Alamosa, Colorado, 3CH Woodend, Victoria, WTND Macon, Illinois, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy and stay tuned.